We are in the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, Oregon. This is the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society, a meeting called Cognition in Flux. But for our purposes, this is also the 10th anniversary, 10 years of the David Rummelhart Prize in Cognitive Science. So there's a symposia on the whole Rummelhart Prize and so on, Outstanding Questions in Cognitive Science. And we are with Robert Goldstone, Chancellor's Professor, University of Indiana, Indiana University in Bloomington.
That's right.
Technically, I suppose you're a psychologist.
I got my PhD in psychology. I got my bachelor's degree in cognitive science.
Oh, okay.
All the way back in whenever that was, 1986, I decided I wanted to be a cognitive scientist. I had to do an individual major then, but I knew there was something in the air.
Okay.
There were all these philosophers, psychologists, computer scientists, linguists, all talking about similar stuff, and I wanted to be part of that.
And I want to ask you actually to try and navigate us through what this field means. I'll come back to that in a minute, but let's first of all just do one thing, just to set the scene here. You're chairman of the Rummelhart Prize.
That's right.
Could you context that for me and tell me, first of all, explain who David Rummelhart is, why the prize exists and so on, what the general range of it is and so on.
Right. So the prize was created 10, 11 years ago. It was the brainchild of Bob Gleschko and Jay McClelland, who is actually this year's recipient right. of the Rummelhart Prize. And it was created as a way of commemorating both the man and the scientist that David Rummelhart was. And he was really an amazing scientist. He was a polyglot. He did field-changing work in psychology and linguistics and computer science. And he really was on the cutting edge of the parallel distributed process way of creating computer systems that would act in human-like ways. And his basic idea was, we don't want to have these serial line-by-line code instructions that the computer would be executing. We want the computer to be thinking, reasoning, learning in ways that are more human-like. And his basic idea was to have many interacting units that were sending small little messages to each other. And the system would learn by changing the strength of the connections between those units. And even though there was nobody in charge, even though there wasn't a single instruction that was being operated on, in this very organic, brain-like way, the kinds of computers that David Rummelhart was creating would be able to learn on their own. And so that was really an amazing discovery. And he went on to apply these in language, in knowledge representation more generally. So he was not just a parallel distributed processor, but he also did very deep work in knowledge representation and how we can have structured thoughts that follow one after another.
Okay, now PDP, parallel distributed processing, this notion of complex networks, the emergence of knowledge in this fashion. Give me some sort of sense of how that is connected, for a general audience, how that is connected with the following terms, connectionism, artificial intelligence. I mean, how do all these things join together? Is PDP one approach within artificial intelligence?
Exactly. That's what it is. So there's many approaches in artificial intelligence which would have a programmer or a knowledge engineer basically type in all of the rules that the computer needed to be following. So if it was a disease diagnosing machine, then you would say, if dry skin, then psoriasis. And it would have many more complicated rules with ands and ors and buts, but it'd basically be set up like that. And so there, the computer is literally doing just what the programmer tells it to do in these if-then statements. If blah, 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 then blah, blah, blah. What is unique about the parallel distributed processing approach, connectionism, is that you don't have to provide that explicit knowledge to the computers at all. You do have to describe how you want the computer to learn, but you don't have to describe the exact knowledge. So you can Yes, it's true that computers only do what you tell them to do, but one of the things that you can tell them to do is learn on their own. And so people like David Rommelhart, Jay McClellan, many of the early pioneers of connectionism, parallel distributed processing, were interested in creating those general systems that would learn on their own.
Okay, in fact, next year is the 25th anniversary of the publication of the volumes on parallel distributed processing, Rommelhart and Jay McClellan, as you mentioned. So there's a nice historical, recent historical, but an interesting historical story, an interesting trail goes on here. I don't know how far you want to go back with it, but as I think about this, I think about, for example, going back to World War II and thinking about somebody like Vannevar Bush, inventing his Memex machine, where he's talking about something that might only be the size of a small room, a desk size, with microfiches and so on, and contain all the world's libraries and so on.
Yeah. right, exactly. You have it on your laptop right there.
But the interesting thing is that he talked about the brain, the way in which the brain handled information as forming associative trails. Mm-hmm. That sounds to me pretty much what we think about these days as well, in terms of the way information is distributed.
I don't Absolutely. Know. There is certainly a long line of history before the PDP books of McClelland and Rommelhart made their big splash in 1986 around. And part of that is Bush's work. Part of it is McCulloch and Pitt's idea of logic-based neurons, right? So these are neurons that are actually being able to calculate symbolic logic, much like we would normally have a mathematician do, and arguing that you can get brains that can do symbolic thought because they have that kind of ability to them. And so there's work on perceptrons and work reacting to perceptrons. So I don't want to say that their work came de novo, but I do think that it made a unique intellectual contribution at its time, and largely because they were able to spell out exactly how the rules for learning would operate and how they would generalize to learn very broad classes of things that you would want a system to learn.
Okay, now, again, just to add a little more context, and we, as you can see, as you can hear, we have a break here in the conference, so there's
a little bit. It's the active, vital nature of cognitive science here.
There are chattering neurons out there, Rob. I just did this for fun. I put in the question, what is cognitive science, into Google?
Yes.
And see what the associative trails are. And there's pages of stuff here with various definitions and so on. I suppose they map onto each other to some extent. There's one here, Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy by Paul Thagard and so on. But would you tell me how you conceive of this?
Sure.
In this sense, if you were a bus driver, I know pretty much what you do when you go into work. You get in and you drive a bus. What does a cognitive scientist do?
Right. And one answer is different cognitive scientists are going to be doing different things because it's an inherently interdisciplinary effort. What unifies us together, I think, is that we're all interested in what is the fundamental nature of minds and how do they work. So I think the premise is that minds are fundamentally different stuff than other things. And whether there's stuff at all is very much a point of contention. So we have basic sciences of matter. We'll leave that to the physicists, you know, a basic science of biology. What is the nature of life? But one of those basic questions, what is the nature of matter? What is the nature of life? To that triumvirate, I would add, what is the nature of mind? And that is really the purview of the cognitive scientist. And the idea is that mind stuff may operate under different principles than physical stuff. So that when I give you a piece of paper, then you now have the piece of paper. I don't have the piece of paper anymore. But when I give you an idea, then magically we both have the idea. Right? So, you know, this stuff of information works differently than this physical stuff. And so we're interested in understanding the laws, the principles, and the machinery for understanding information. And so that is, to me, what is fundamental to cognitive science.
Okay, so information processing, but to some people, as you said, you know, mind is the M word. I mean, they would rather just talk about brains and what neurons do, mm-hmm. Rather than mind stuff. And yet, as you know, the Science Network deals with issues at the intersection of science and social policy. I'm very much interested in how the science of educating, for example. You're a member of the advisory board of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center,
right,
that we work with at UCSD.
Right.
When politicians are trying to implement policy, you would hope they would do it from a science-based perspective.
Exactly.
And this is not just education, health, and so on and so forth. You'd think that there would be a standard issue model of what a mind is, because we're dealing with people here, and shouldn't we have some sense of what whose behalf we're doing it on? I mean, what is there a generalized view of what a mind is, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I completely agree with you that the place of science in society more broadly is it should be the vehicle by which we progress in a systematic way. So the very nature of science is creating innovations, creating hypotheses, and then trying to systematically test them to see which ones are working. So I think it's our best bet to trying to have a world which is guaranteed of moving in the right direction towards progress. You may get lucky if you're not using science, but it would just be luck. So if you want to systematically make progress, then I think this is the only game in town. Sometimes I feel like society is too interested in the immediate payoff. It reminds me of, like, if you hold a dog biscuit in front of a dog, but the dog is on a leash that's looped around a tree, the dog is not smart enough, right? So he's going, ha, give me the dog biscuit, and the dog biscuit is just out of reach, and he's just going to sit there, right? And that seems to me like society, who wants the instant payoff, the immediate gratification. Whereas if you step back and look at your world systematically, if you were the dog, you would say, oh, I first have to unwrap myself around the tree, and then I can make progress. And so I feel that what scientists should really be aiming at in a public policy context is establishing a procedure where we're not just greedily into it for the immediate payoff, but we're trying to set up procedures that we know will work in the long run. And so in the education world that you were talking about before, if you are a cognitive scientist looking at a student trying to, second grader trying to add numbers, and Johnny comes to you and says, 11 plus 5, okay, I guess that would be 7. Wrong answer, okay? What's 21 plus 5? I think the answer would be 8. If you are a behaviorist or somebody who is interested not in what's going on in the mental world, then you would just say, oh, they're getting the wrong answer. Let's punish them, or let's not reward them. But if you're a cognitive scientist, then you're interested in trying to figure out what is going on in the mental representations that the student has and the processes that are working on those representations to give the wrong answer. And you might entertain hypotheses like, oh, they're just adding up all of the numbers. They don't realize that 11 has a 1 in the tens place, a 1 in the ones place, so it's actually more than just 2. They're just adding 1 plus 1 plus 5 to get the number 7. So a cognitive science perspective is always going to be looking at things a little bit deeper, I think, and trying to say, what is it about the way that they're structuring their world that is making them give this set of wrong answers, and how can we intervene to correct that?
Okay, so there's been a spate of books recently. I mean, you're also talking there about how policy-making bodies make decisions, and to extend your analogy there of using of the imperfect mathematics.
Right.
There, many people would say there's some imperfect decisions being made in their view.
Yeah.
There's been a spate of books about decision making recently. I suppose that's a good sign?
I think it's a great sign. I mean, in some ways, it seems to me that the economists are just now beginning to discover cognitive science. And there's this large area of growth in behavioral economics,
right,
which is all predicated on the idea that we are not always perfectly rational creatures, right? And that is very important. When you think about it, it seems obvious to you, it seems obvious to me as cognitive scientists, but to the economists, they were so long living in this world of rational
Homo economicus.
Homo economicus, yeah. Where they say, hey, we're all doing exactly what we should do given our beliefs, goals, and desires, when we don't. And we know so many cases of NBA millionaire basketball players who fret about a $20 fine that they get charged when they're late for a practice, right? We know so many situations where people will continue with a retirement program if it's the default option for them, but they won't invest in it if it's not the default option for them, if they have to do just a tiny little bit of work in order to enter into this retirement program, which could make a difference of $500,000 to them in the long run, right? They spend more time thinking about what tennis racket to buy than they do what retirement program to invest in. So we know people are not rational, and that is exactly why cognitive science perspective on public policy is important. We need to know not just how people should be behaving, but how people do behave.
Now, you touched on this in an earlier answer, but let me ask you the question anyway, since it's one that I routinely ask people. As he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
But he gave no coordinates, in your view. So what is the rightful place of science?
You know, what I would really like to see science's rightful place in society is as a incubator for ways to improve the way the world is working. So I would love to see virtual worlds or rule systems or large sets of data on how people are purchasing or making decisions in their everyday life, and using that to systematically tweak the rule systems that we're living under in society to try to see if we can come up with rule systems that lead to better collective outcomes for everybody. So I would like to see a more empirical approach to what makes society work. Should we have a society in which certain drugs are legal versus illegal? It would be great to not just think that we know the answer, but to try out, have a test bed community where you have one policy, another test bed community where you don't have that policy. See where things are thriving more. So that would be a great way of applying science to the real world, I think. And we are inundated by data that we could be using to make these informed choices. Businesses make tiny tweaks to their advertisement to see what is changing our buying behavior. They are approaching their system scientifically because there's big money in it. I think that we should be doing the same thing for our society, for the rules in which we're living by. We should be looking at the virtual worlds to see what makes somebody spend so much time on World of Warcraft, in Second Life. What is it about the incentive structures in those worlds that make people want to spend their time, that grab their eyeballs, grab their brains, CPU cycles, right? Why are those so much more attractive? And maybe we can reverse engineer them and put some of those incentives in our everyday world. So I see an interesting competition between where our brain is going to be going.
Yeah, I was at a meeting the other evening in Seattle discussing the notion. It was about the science of educating and about what kind of tools you could use, drawing on neuroscience, cognitive science, evidence, and so on, to improve and optimize the performance of the one thing that's common to everybody on the planet, which is the 3 pounds of wonder tissue up here, all right?
Yeah.
And people, well, this point was brought up, World of Warcraft. Somebody said, do you know what the most Google pages are? The most number of Google pages? Yep. World of Warcraft.
Okay,
so
great.
This is a huge enterprise, which you can look at and say, well, what a waste of time, kids playing.
Exactly.
But you're right. Somebody then said, there's the model. How do we build sims, simulations, environments in which children can do things where, in fact, there's a learning experience going on that's useful in the whole science of educating as well.
Right.
So
right.
Do you buy into that?
Yeah, it's amazing. So what is it with World of Warcraft that people will bump their heads against something that seems to me completely frustrating, completely boring, and they're completely absorbed into it? Whereas if they're in their classroom, they've got no interest in learning how to add these two fractions. So this is partially cognitive. A large part of it is going to be motivational. How do we change how we're motivating students in a way that they're treating their work in school, learning to read, learning mathematics, in a way that will resemble their gaming experience? So I think that's a huge question that's going to become increasingly important. I think that really the killer app for cognitive science is transforming education. So cognitive scientists know deeply about learning, which is really what the core of education is, right? And so the excitement to me about cognitive science is we have deep understandings of the mechanism of learning, thanks to people like David Rummelhart, that the Rummelhart Prize is named after. We know a lot about learning, and so we can take that mechanistic knowledge of how people learn to try to change the educational system so that they're getting a better bang for their buck, a bigger bang for the amount of time they're putting into learning. And there's many good examples of applications of cognitive science to improving education. We know that it's better to space out material over time rather than compress all of that material that you want somebody to learn in one interval. It's better to interleave study and testing. Study a little bit of information and then test people to make sure they understand it. Don't just do a block of study or a block of test. It's better to give a little bit of both.
So the spacing effects and so on.
Yeah, and there is spacing and interleaving. So these are principles that we know work. We know comparison works. The way to get people to understand a deep principle is by having them compare two instances of that principle. So I think that we're well poised now to be able to now transform our cognitive science knowledge into educational policies, into curricula that will confer better results for our students.
So when it says here that your research interests include concept learning, representation, perceptual learning, collective behavior, and computational modeling of human cognition.
Yeah, right.
This is all the kind of stuff you've been talking about here. Does this mean you also work with sample groups and so on?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we do work in school systems. So we're in the K-12 school system, both learning mathematics, learning science, and we're very much interested in this question of how do students learn abstract information? How do we take advantage of the millions of years of research and development that Mother Nature or evolution has put into designing our brains, right? And it turns out that it's put a lot of work into developing our perceptual systems. About 70% of the brain is dedicated to perception. So how do we use those perceptual parts of the brain in order to allow us to understand abstract information like algebra? We were not evolved in a world where people needed to learn algebra. And yet algebra is considered to be important for us to know now, and I agree that it is. I think our only way of really having people understand it is to try to ground it in our perceptual skills.
When you talk about models of the mind, and you talk about evolution, natural selection, and adaptationist strategies, and so on, there is nevertheless, as you know, a continuing debate about what are built-ins, as it were, what's reliably developing in the genome. a modular mind with skills and so on already available,
yeah,
versus a very connectionist view, which says, a very constructivist view, which says, no, we build most of this stuff as we go along.
Yeah.
Those are obviously extremes, but there is still this debate going on, as I understand it anyway, between
a
nativist
right.
and empiricist kind of views and so on, however it's characterized now. How has that debate shifted, and where do you think things have settled at this point?
Right. Interesting question. One recent trend in developmental psychology, I think, can be characterized by saying how much of this structure that we have in our mind can actually be acquired during the lifetime of the organism rather than built in. So it used to be argued that you need to say that the mind is constrained. If you don't have constraints or biases, then learning itself is impossible. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to Noam Chomsky, Gould's thesis, which says that if you don't have these kinds of constraints on hypotheses that you will entertain, for example, in language learning, then you'll never be able to learn language in a finite amount of time, let alone the 2 years that it takes a baby to actually learn language. And so they argue that you have to have these built-in constraints in order to learn anything. And I think there is an interesting trend in developmental psychology which would say, yes, you have to have constraints and biases to get ahead, but some of those constraints and biases can actually be learned themselves. And so you can have an organism that starts off relatively general purpose, and it becomes a more special purpose device over its own lifetime. And so that's an interesting approach that I see in the work of Moore Christensen, Linda Smith, some of the Bayesian cognitive scientists out there, Charles Kemp, Josh Tenenbaum, are also having versions of that account. And so I find it an interesting reconciliation.
So, and in fact, you would, if I talked to Patricia Churchton, for example, she would talk very much about constraint satisfaction issues. I mean, that's how things work. So, but you're talking about the whole process of constraint satisfaction also itself being, to some extent, an acquired
Absolutely.
Skill.
That's right. So there's loops within loops.
Right.
One of the things that we do is one of the things that we do, which is amazing, is we build tools that are going to help us think better. And we build tools like mathematics that will help us build those tools. So there is definitely a sense in which it is not all built in, because we benefit from our predecessors, the previous mathematicians, the previous brilliant thinkers like Euler, who gave us Euler diagrams or Venn diagram tools to help us
think
better. And so those are not part of our evolutionary legacy. It's all one form of constraint, giving more constraints. So we are not born knowing Venn diagrams or knowing algebra, but we are born being able to acquire those. So I think of the tools that we create as constraining us, both good and bad, mostly good, I think. But once we have these tools, they then change the game for what's going to be able to take place in us and others and of our kin down the road.
Yeah. So is this something that you always knew that you were going to get into or as you were growing up? I mean, did you have influence from parents or a teacher or a book?
The book which was most influential to me, which I read when I was in high school, was Doug Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach, which I think is responsible for bringing in many cognitive scientists into the field, probably more so than any other book. And I read that and I said, wow, this is really interesting stuff on consciousness, free will, computers, what is the nature of thought.
It also has music in there and Roger Shepherd and
exactly.
the Shepherd tone.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely. Fascinating stuff combining together music and art and philosophy and logic. And I was coming into it as a typical geek, a computer geek. So I was spending all my time programming in high school and college. And my own interest at the time was pattern recognition. How do you get a system so that it can recognize A when you write it in different ways? An A like this, an A like this, an A like that. And it was turning out to be a surprisingly hard problem. Of course, in the intervening 40 years, it's been solved. Basically, we have systems that can recognize handwritten letters extremely well. At the time, it wasn't solved, and I began to be interested in people from the perspective of, how are people doing it? We know we have an existence proof that this is a solvable problem because every four-year-old kid can recognize an A. So I became very interested in people. You know, how are people able to do this so effortlessly? Right? How can they recognize A's? And that's not the only thing they do. They can also recognize their grandmother. They can also learn a language. They can also count. And so how is this device, this person, able to do all of these things? It's really a magnum opus that this thing exists, and we, each of us, is one of those things. So for me, part of cognitive science is a process of not taking ourselves for granted and for realizing what amazing things we are, beasts we are, or devices we are, whatever you want to use as your metaphor for what people are. We're incredibly sophisticated thinkers. And so I decided to take a bit of time off of my computer programming to study how people are able to do what they're able to do. Of course, that digression has lasted 30, 40 years for me.
Yeah. I'm actually thinking, as you said, how wonderful we are. About a little conversation that's been going on in the New York Times over the last little while. The latest blast was August 9th, Jaron Lanier. The headline is "The First Church of Robotics." And there's a line in here where he says, "In fact, the nuts and bolts of AI research, artificial intelligence research, can often be more usefully interpreted without the concept of AI at all." And it's
yeah. Is this just
people worried about robots and stuff, or what?
Yeah, I see the problem that Jaron is talking about, but I have a different solution than what he points out.
What do you think is the problem he's talking
about? So the problem that he's pointing out is the hype which is associated with artificial intelligence. In order to get a name for yourself as an artificial intelligence researcher, you have to say, my system is amazing. It can think in human-like ways. It can play chess better than any human being that we know.
It can win game shows.
We can Jeopardy questions, exactly. It can answer these questions better than anybody else that we know. And that's all well and good, but what is oftentimes behind the scenes is that there's a series of kludges, engineering tricks, that allow the system to do what it's doing apparently so well. So it turns out that the best chess playing programs don't play chess in a human-like way at all, really. They're considering many, many more moves than any grandmaster would consider. And they're able to do it just because of the processing speed of the computer that's running. So I agree with Jaron that there's too much hype in artificial intelligence, and oftentimes it would be better not to say this is a thinking system, but just to talk about it as a information retrieval system or something that can play this class of games in an effective way. To me, what cognitive science's perspective on this is that we should step back and really take a hard look at how people are able to do what they're able to do and try to really create automated systems that behave in more human-like ways. And that's exactly going back to what you started asking me about at the beginning, where the Rummelhart Prize winners come in. Because I see what these Rummelhart Prize winners as doing is not just trying for creating systems by engineering tricks, by kludges, by secret little shortcuts where you have like a Wizard of the Oz where there's a nice veneer on the front, but there's really nothing underneath. Instead, what I think the Rummel Harp Prize winners are distinctive for doing is really trying to deeply investigate what is at the core of cognition. So they're interested in not just creating a chess playing program, but creating a program that would learn how to play chess or learn how to play any kind of game. They're interested in something that can't just recognize this particular letter in this type font, but are interested in what is the basic nature of pattern recognition, whether it's letters or faces, words, or entire essays.
Well, I see in some of the questions that will come up in the symposium, because this won't air until after it, Roger Shepherd, for example, is actually talking about cognitive science, whether it can provide rational grounds for universally valid moral principles. That's a big topic. Yeah. Susan Carey, you know, talking about what processes underlie the creation of new concepts.
Yes.
So, you know, Shimon Ullman, innate structures, will a digital baby need to acquire meaningful concepts?
Yes.
Jeff Ellman, how does development work? I mean, these are big, substantial questions.
Yes.
I'm also reminded, of course, that the human system itself, if you go along with Gary Marcus's book, is Ramachandran, is a great deal of kludging itself. So.
Right. So. That's an interesting point. So right, and so Gary Marcus has the book called Kludge, and so wouldn't it be an irony if the deep nature of human cognition is nothing but kludges? Right. And I think that can't be completely right. So despite Gary Marcus being a smart guy, I think there's got to be some general purpose learning devices, just because we did not evolve in a context where chess was important, where algebra was important, and yet we are able to acquire these. So there has to be a sense in which the most practical thing for an organism like us to do is to be able to adapt itself to new situations. So there's a problem if you want to create a system that only does these three things: forage for food, find mating partners, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because the game is changing, especially for cultural, social creatures like humans are. We have to adapt to culture, which is changing not on the courses of millions of years, but changing in the courses of tens of years now.
Yeah, yeah. If you were advising a young scientist, now this is a question I often ask people, what would be your advice to a young scientist be at this point?
So if you're pursuing cognitive science, I think it would be great to get a toolkit under your belt that includes mathematical sophistication, computer programming, logic. Those are going to be the kinds of tools that are going to see you through your career, whatever course it's going to take. I recommend reading broadly, not just in your area. Purposely force yourself to come up to ideas that don't see eye to eye with your own approach. If you're an innatist, talk to somebody from an empiricist bent. If you believe that everything is learned, talk to somebody who is doing genetic psychology, right? So I think you learn, you grow when you challenge yourself.
Okay. Is there anything else that you could ever thought you might have done as a career, or was it always going to be science for you? I mean, you're not a frustrated rock musician or something.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm lucky I found any job at all. If I couldn't be an academic in science, I'd just be on the street in Portland asking for alms. You know, I mean, many people have more interesting backgrounds than I do. I always knew that I wanted to be some kind of scientist. Yeah. I wanted to be a microscopist or in biology when I was younger, and I got more interest in philosophy, which brought me into an interest in cognitive science. But I guess early on, I knew I wanted to understand nature.
So microscopy, did that get you interested in the history of science there? You know, like van Leeuwenhoek and Robert Hooke and so on, the micrographia and so on.
Oh, yeah. Those are great researchers. That would have been a wonderful time to be, where you're looking at this sample and you're seeing all these tiny animalcules, as they called them. They didn't know what they were. You know, we'd call them protozoa now. But what is that? There's something underneath there. That would have been a weird phenomena. You think that you see life around you, and you realize there's a whole order of life below you. All of these protozoa, all of these bacteria, and you realize that every drop of water is just teeming with life. That would have made my head spin to be there when that was discovered.
Let me give you a time travel token then. You can have a dinner party, and you can bring any guests in that you would like to ask some questions of. Is there anybody you've been dying to have a conversation with?
I guess my hero is Charles Darwin. That combines cognitive science and biology. He is unique because he had this big picture. You know, he had a theory, and yet he was extremely interested in the details. If you read Origin of Species, it's all about how this plant is curving one way versus curving another way. So it's a beautiful example of what I think cognitive science should be aspiring to, which is synthesizing. Keep your eye on the prize, keep your eye on the big picture, but also spell it out with detailed working examples. And he just populates his book with example after example that, you know, can, to all but the most undenying person, would convince anybody that there are these connections across species. This baboon is acting a lot like this chimpanzee, is acting a lot like this Homo sapiens. And to be able to tie them together, to see the unification, but also to appreciate the diversity. That was amazing to me. So yeah, I wouldn't mind having a tea with Chuck.
Tea with Chuck. He of course went on to sort of start touching on, well, not just touching on, but his great book on the emotions and so on, and he moved on to psychology, well, what we would now call psychology. William James then continues this amazing tradition. William James, another hero of yours?
Absolutely, right. The principles of psychology, it's a touchstone. So when I try to get my graduate students to study for their qualifying exams, it's very common for me just to say, start with the basics. Start with volume one and volume two of William James. He's laying out the basic conceptual problems of attention, of consciousness, of free will, that are still with us today. And without the benefit of countless experiments, he still was able to see through his anecdotes, through his phenomenology, through his self-examination. He was able to see through to many of the theories that we're now only working out now.
Let me just ask you another thing on education, since we're both involved in the same Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, Science of Learning Center, Science of Educating. I sense really good traction here and a lot of great research that can be implemented and used. What's your take on it at this point?
I completely agree. So of course, I'll say what scientists always say, more research is necessary, right, at the end of every paper. So what we can say in conclusion is fund us for another 20 years. Right. So I don't want to give the impression that we can go out there and change education right now, given what we know, and be sure that it's going to work. I think that right now we can say that we have enough knowledge so that we can point at ways of improving education. And it would be great to enter into dialogue with those educators on how to implement those changes. We still need to be doing work to be able to say, this is exactly why this is working. But there's many principles out there, systematic idealizations. So situations where you don't want to make the material that you give students as realistic as possible. They tend to get sucked into the details, possibly. Mm. But situations where you want to try to caricature, cartoon, idealize the material, and that will allow them to zoom into the critical component that you want them to learn. So we have principles like that I would love to see more implemented in educational curricula. So I do think this is an exciting time. I think this is really the killer app for cognitive science. our education system, if not in a shambles, it's very much in dire need of improvement. And I think there are things that we can do to improve it. The whole use of computers to try to improve education, we're only just beginning to scratch the surface of that. The use of robots, like what Javier Mavellan is doing at your institution, that's exciting, and I think there's way more that can be done with that.
This overall meeting title here that the Rummelhart's part of, Cognition in Flux.
Yes.
And I'm looking at a series of papers here, which are articles in press, I assume they're still in press, at TICS, okay. Trends in Cognitive Science.
Okay. Right.
And there's a paper by Jay McClelland and others. There are responses from, about letting structure emerge, connectionist and dynamical systems approaches to cognition. There's a primary response paper from Alison Gopnik, Henry Wellman, Susan Gelman, mm-hmm. Andy Meltzoff, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Computational Foundation. And then there's responses again, commentaries by a group of other folks, Jerry Feldman, Josh Tenenbaum is one of the authors here, as you mentioned. So there's still a debate going on here, and the first paragraph of the Gopnik response is saying a deep theoretical tension lies at the heart of developmental cognitive science. Children, even infants, have abstract, structured representations of the world, intuitive theories and grammars, conceptual hierarchies, phonological maps. At the same time, children learn, they transform their representations, and so on and so forth. And you know, this goes on. We don't need to go into the exact details right now, but my point is that this is obviously still in flux.
Absolutely, yes.
And where do you see it going? I mean,
and that's the way it has to go, right? That's the way it has to be, right? So science is always in flux, right? Science, if I were a Zen Buddhist, you know, I would say science is a journey. It's not the final destination. So it's healthy and it's useful that it's in flux. We shouldn't be knowing all the answers. We'll never know all the answers. What we can hope to do is articulate a better set of questions. And that's exactly what the Rummelhart Prize winners are going to be doing on Saturday. They're going to be trying to articulate what their main questions are. So I think that the debate that Gopnik and McClelland are engaged in is extremely healthy. I think the vitality of the people that you can hear milling around downstairs is another example of that. So there's many new movements in cognitive science that I find exciting. Linking back the mind with the brain and the body and the larger environment that the organism finds itself in. That's an exciting trend, I think, in cognitive science. Applying these Bayesian tools is another exciting development. Really applying formal modeling to understanding the mind, which is not at all a formal system at all. It's just this gooey bit of brain, right? And yet, these models from Bayesian methods are doing an interesting, good job of explaining some aspects. The tension between symbolic, formally minded cognitive science and sub-symbolic, parallel, distributed, emergent cognition is fascinating. And I don't think that one view is going to win out. It's going to be, of course, a synthesis between these views to show how you can get the symbolic activity emerging out of the subsymbolic goo.
Okay, so last question. What are you optimistic about?
So I'm optimistic that we will be able to apply some of these tools from cognitive science to make progress in education, make progress in the remediation of lower class citizens in various ways, for improving neurologically impaired patients, for improving society and the incentive structures in society. And what I would say is unique about all of those kinds of problems that society is facing is that all of them are going to be only tackleable if we combine together people with very different skill sets. So if we're trying to understand how to improve the outcomes of patients with Alzheimer's. It's not just going to be neuroscientists. It's going to be behavioral psychologists who can create better tests for when somebody is suffering from Alzheimer's. It's going to be computer scientists who are able to create systems for remediation with the Alzheimer's patients. It's going to be biologists. It's going to be linguists, because many of the Alzheimer's patients' problems are language-oriented. For all of the problems I suggested, it's going to be a team of people from different fields who are able to understand each other and communicate at a high level. And that is why cognitive science is.
Rob Goldstone, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Great talking to you.